Are you ready to dive deeper into Tolkien's world? If you've ever struggled to read The Silmarillion, I've got just the thing for you. I've created a free guide packed with my best tips to help you conquer this epic book. Whether you're a seasoned reader or tackling it for the first time, this guide will make your journey through the first age of Middle-earth more rewarding than ever. Head over to ringspodcast.com to download your free guide today. Your adventure deeper into Middle-earth starts now. Visit ringspodcast.com today for your free guide. If you're like me, you've probably lost entire afternoons down the behind-the-scenes rabbit hole of bonus content for the Lord of the Rings movies. The cast antics, the miniature sets the size of your living room, and did you know that Viggo Mortensen broke his toe when he kicked that helmet? We love it. But have you ever wondered about the behind-the-scenes of the book? Because it turns out the story of how The Lord of the Rings made it to print is every bit as quirky, uncertain, and unexpected as anything that happened in Peter Jackson's New Zealand. Titles changed, publishers hesitated, prices skyrocketed, and poor Tolkien just wanted to get his monster of a story out into the world. Today we're wandering into one of those behind-the-scenes tales. Is The Lord of the Rings one book, three books, or six books? What other titles did Tolkien toss around in those frenzied letters to his publisher? And why wasn't it published all at once, like Tolkien intended? Grab your pipeweed and a spot by the fire, because this is the book bonus content you never knew you needed. I'm Aaron, your host and guide to wandering Middle-earth, especially for first-time readers of Tolkien's works. Visit ringspodcast.com to find my free downloadable guides for reading The Silmarillion and other works by J.R.R. Tolkien. Now, let's wander. It's easy to forget that The Lord of the Rings wasn't always the towering, world-shaping literary legend it is today. Back when Tolkien finished it in the early 1950s, it was, well, a bit of a problem. And not just a little one, but literally a big problem. The thing about writing a gigantic story filled with elves, ancient bloodlines, invented languages, and talking trees is that eventually someone has to print the thing, and printing costs money, quite a lot of it, especially in post-war Britain, where paper shortages and economic recovery made big books hard to sell. In a letter to his publisher, Rainer Unwin, in October 1952, Tolkien confessed, quote, "I regret very much, in some ways, having produced such a monster in such unpropitious days." And it wasn't false modesty. The monster he was talking about was, of course, The Lord of the Rings itself, which by then had ballooned into a sprawling epic with deep backstory and lore stacked so high you need a dwarf's pickaxe to dig your way through it. When Tolkien turned in his manuscript, the first printer estimated the unit cost to be £3.10. Now, for anyone unfamiliar with post-World War II British currency, let's just say it wasn't cheap. And that was just if they printed it all in one enormous volume. If they split it into more than one, the price would go even higher. To put that in perspective, I did a little calculating. Depending on how you measure inflation, £3.10 in the early 1950s is roughly 44 to 145 US dollars in today's money. And that's not for a deluxe collector's edition with a gilded slipcase and a fold-out map of Middle-earth printed on elvish parchment. No, that was just for your regular run-of-the-mill copy. Just for perspective, today you can order a copy of The Lord of the Rings Deluxe Illustrated by the Author Special Edition, which is absolutely gorgeous, by the way, for a whopping $100. So, in a weird way, Tolkien's publishing problem is something book lovers still bump into today. Beautiful, hefty tomes cost money. And sometimes that means tough decisions about what gets published, how it's divided up, and how much readers will be asked to pay. But in 1952, Tolkien was stuck. The story was finished, all 1,200 pages of it, and now it was up to his publisher, Allen and Unwin, to figure out how to get it into the hands of readers without requiring them to sell their grandmother's silverware to afford a copy. After some wrangling, the decision was made to split it into three volumes. Now, this wasn't because the story naturally fell into three tidy parts. We'll get to that in a bit. But because it was the only realistic way to print and sell the thing. As Tolkien later wrote, quote, "I had much difficulty in getting the thing into print at all, and had to bow to the decision that it was too large and expensive to to issue in one dollop at between 3 and 4 pounds. Instead, they landed on 21 shillings per volume, which by today's numbers is somewhere between $15 and $49, depending on the inflation math you prefer. And honestly, that's not too far off from where a solid hardcover edition would run you these days. The more things change, the more they stay the same, I guess. And so The Lord of the Rings was released to the world in three parts. Not because Tolkien thought of it as a trilogy. In fact, he absolutely didn't, more on that in a moment. But because paper, printers, and post-war pocketbooks demanded it. Now here's where things get even better. If you're picturing Tolkien stomping around the house in his tweed jacket, fuming about commercial compromises, well, you're not wrong. He was, to put it mildly, not thrilled. Not thrilled. He called the decision a piecemeal method, and later lamented that breaking the story up like that made it feel shapeless to early reviewers and readers. And he had a point. If you've ever read The Fellowship of the Ring and thought, huh, this kind of ends abruptly, or picked up The Two Towers and thought, wait, where's Frodo? Why are we in Rohan all of a sudden? Now you know why. But we'll get to that frustration in more detail in just a moment. For now, it's worth pausing to appreciate just how close The Lord of the Rings came to being a single, giant, unwieldy book that probably would have been too expensive for most readers to buy. In another world, Middle-earth might have remained the private playground of a handful of Oxford dons and students. Or maybe it would have been released in a limited, collectors-only edition, gathering dust on the top shelf of obscure bookshops while the rest of us missed out entirely. Instead, through a combination of practical publishing, economics, and sheer stubborn determination, it made its way into the world in a format people could afford, and in doing so, quietly began rewriting the rules of modern fantasy publishing. And if you hear someone call The Lord of the Rings a trilogy, don't feel compelled to channel your inner Ted Mosby, well, actually, and correct them. Just don't. Please don't. This isn't the kind of factoid. It's not ammunition for correcting your friends. It's one of those, if you know, you know kind of a things. The kind that you share over drinks or on a hike through the woods or in the back pages of a secondhand bookshop while leafing through a battered old edition with that comforting smell of old paper and pipe smoke. So The Lord of the Rings is split into three volumes. Problem solved, right? Well, not quite, because now someone had to figure out what to actually call those volumes. And this, my fellow wanderer, is where we get a peek into Tolkien's wonderfully fussy, delightfully obsessive, and detail-oriented brain. Because while the publishing team was mainly worried about logistics, Tolkien was obsessing about titles. Here's the thing. The Lord of the Rings wasn't written in three parts. It was originally conceived as six so-called books, within one continuous narrative, each with its own internal rhythm and arc, but no neat division that would lend itself to tidy volume breaks. Splitting the story into three wasn't a natural fit for the way the story was told. In March of 1953, Tolkien wrote to his publisher, Rainer Unwin, about this very problem, quote, "I have given some thought to the matter of subtitles for the volumes, which you thought were desirable." He says, in what feels like the most polite academic grumbling ever, he goes on, quote, "But I do not find it easy, as the books, though they may be grouped in pairs, are not really paired, and the middle pair, 3 and 4, are not really related." Translation: you're asking me to invent titles for the unnatural groupings of my story, and I don't like it. Tolkien nonetheless gave it a go. In the same letter, he floated one of the earliest possible title combinations. In the books for Volume 1, The Ring Sets Out and The Ring Goes South. In the books for Volume 2, The Treason of Isengard and The Ring Goes East. And in Volume number 3, The War of the Ring and The End of the Third Age. Hey, that's not bad at all. They sound very Tolkien-y, don't they? But in typical fashion, he wasn't satisfied. Humphrey Carpenter, the editor behind the published Letters of J.R.R. Tolkien, even noted another set of possible titles Tolkien jotted down in a manuscript draft. The First Journey, The Journey of the Nine Companions, The Treason of Isengard, The Journey of the Ringbearers, The War of the Ring, and The End of the Third Age. Remember, he's giving titles for each of the individual six books, not necessarily the three volumes. By August of 1953, Tolkien proposed yet another title scheme. this time with only a title for each of the three volumes. Quote, "The Lord of the Rings is a good overall title, I think, but it is not applicable especially to Volume 1. Indeed, it is probably least suited to that volume. Except possibly in the matter of cost, I cannot see objection to Lord of the Rings 1, Return of the Shadow, 2, The Shadow Lengthens, 3, The Return of the King. I am not wedded to any of these suggested subtitles and wish they could be avoided, for it is really impossible to devise ones that correspond to the contents, since the division into two books per volume is purely a matter of convenience with regard to length and has no relation to the rhythm or ordering of the narrative." This is one of my favorite things about Tolkien. He cared. He cared a lot. Not in a perfectionist for the sake of perfection sense, but because the rhythm, shape, and meaning of a story mattered to him. He wasn't just slapping titles on a product to get it out the door. He was trying to honor the internal logic of the story world he'd spent decades building. Eventually, after much back and forth, and one suspects a fair amount of weary sighing from both sides, they landed on the titles we know today. In a letter dated August 17, 1953, Tolkien wrote, quote, "I now suggest as titles of the volumes, under the overall title The Lord of the Rings, Volume 1, The Fellowship of the Ring, Volume 2, The Two Towers, Volume 3, The War of the Ring, or if you still prefer that, The Return of the King." There you can see the three main titles that we know today. And this gives insight into an interesting and little remarked upon fact. Today, when we say the Fellowship, we often mean the nine companions, including Frodo the Ringbearer, who set out from Rivendell. We say things like, "Which member of the Fellowship would you want to sit next to on the plane?" And we all know the nine options that we can choose from. I would choose Aragorn, by the way. But here's the catch. Tolkien didn't write the story with the title Fellowship of the Ring in mind, and so he rarely refers to the group as the Fellowship in that volume. Read closely and you always see him call it The Company, with a capital C. And yes, I know the last chapter is called The Breaking of the Fellowship, but again, read it carefully. Is he referring to a group, or is he referring to the friendship and support that they gave each other along the way? Go read that chapter and see for yourself. The Two Towers is another curious one. Tolkien noted that it was as close as he could get to a title that made sense for both books 3 and 4, which follow the split narrative paths of Aragorn's company in Rohan and Frodo and Sam's harrowing journey through Emyn Mule, Ithilien, and eventually to the brink of Mordor. But can you name which two towers the title refers to exactly? If you have Peter Jackson's film interpretation in your mind, then I know what you are thinking. But are those the two towers that Tolkien had in mind? Maybe, and maybe not. Tolkien loved the ambiguity it offered, and even suggested three different pairings of towers that might be referred to. Quote, "The Two Towers gets as near as possible to finding a title to cover the widely divergent books 3 and 4, and can be left ambiguous. It might refer to Isengard and Barad-dûr, or to Minas Tirith and Barad-dûr, or Isengard and Cirith Ungol. Send me an email at host@ringspodcast.com about which of those pairs of towers you like to think are the two, and I'll respond to you with my own thoughts as well. Another funny tidbit, even here, Tolkien wasn't quite happy with the Return of the King title. He preferred The War of the Ring because it gave away less about the ending. He was famously cagey about spoilers. Even the chapter titles in The Lord of the Rings were carefully chosen to reveal just enough to intrigue, but not enough to ruin the tension. As he wrote, quote, "The chapter titles have been chosen also to give away as little as possible in advance." It's one of those small moments where publishing pragmatism meets literary mystery, and both walk away satisfied. Well, mostly. Tolkien, true to form, would keep tinkering with titles and chapter headings for years. So much of what we take for granted about The Lord of the Rings, its division into three parts, its familiar titles, were not the result of some grand design from the start. They were practical decisions, negotiated between a fiercely particular professor and a pragmatic publisher trying to sell books in a tough post-war economy. Which again is one of those lovely, if you know, you know details. It doesn't change the experience of the story one bit if you don't know. But if you do, it adds this extra layer of texture to your next reread. When you flip the page from the Fellowship of the Ring to the Two Towers, you'll know there's a little invisible asterisk floating there. A reminder of debates over paper costs, title lists scribbled in pencil, and one stubborn author trying to guard his story's integrity while getting it into readers' hands.
Lowe's knows to bring your vision to life, it's important to find the right color. That's why my Lowe's Rewards members get a free paint or exterior stain sample to test your look and find the perfect color to confidently refresh your space. Lowe's, we help, you save. Offer valid in-store only, 5/8 through 5/14. Limit one per customer while supplies last. Discount taken at time of purchase. See associate for details. Program subject to terms and conditions. Details at lowes.com/terms. Subject to change.
So by this point, we've got The Lord of the Rings split into three volumes, with titles Tolkien felt were acceptable at best. The books were printed, sent to shops, and began making their way into readers' hands. And that should have been the end of the story, right? Not quite. Because as soon as those three books hit shelves, something curious happened. People started calling it a trilogy. Now, to be fair, it kind of looks like a trilogy. Three books, three titles, published one after the other. That's the definition of a trilogy, is it not? Except here's the thing. The Lord of the Rings is not a trilogy. Not even a little bit. And Tolkien was not thrilled about this. In September 1954, just after The Fellowship of the Ring was published, and weeks before The Two Towers would be out in the wild, Tolkien wrote to his publisher about the unavoidable downside of releasing it in three parts. Quote, "The unavoidable disadvantage of issuing in three parts has been shown in the shapelessness that several readers have found, since that is true if one volume is supposed to stand alone. Trilogy, which is not really accurate, is partly to blame." Translation? Readers were reading The Fellowship of the Ring as if it were meant to be a self-contained novel, with a beginning, middle, and end, instead of the first leg of a much longer journey. And when the book naturally ended with Frodo and Sam striking off toward Mordor alone, readers unfamiliar with Tolkien's grander vision felt a little, well, unsatisfied. And you can't really blame them. In the 1950s, most readers expected a story to resolve itself within a book's covers, or at least within a clearly marked series structure. And Tolkien's story, with its six internally divided books crammed into three volumes for reasons of paper costs and post-war practicality, did not fit that mold. But it wasn't just a question of reader expectations. It was about what kind of story The Lord of the Rings was always meant to be. In a letter to a friend, Hugh Brogan, written just days after that letter to his publisher, Tolkien pulled no punches. Quote, "I was all against this piecemeal method, as the work is certainly not a trilogy, as the publishers dubbed it while my eye was off the ball, being in Ireland or immersed in exams. But one story with a single shape." There's a little hint of academic snark there, too. You can hear Tolkien muttering, "Leave the room for 5 minutes, and they go and start calling it a trilogy." And this is what makes the whole thing so fascinating to me. Because The Lord of the Rings was written from the start as a continuous, unified narrative. Not three stories loosely connected, not three standalone episodes. One long, sprawling tale with a single through line, the fate of the One Ring and the world it threatens to destroy. As if it were all linked to a majestic whole, Tolkien might say. In fact, Tolkien had originally planned to publish The Lord of the Rings together with The Silmarillion, in a massive double-decker volume of legend and myth. That idea was quickly shut down by his publisher for being wildly impractical, and let's be honest, completely unaffordable for most readers. But it gives you a sense of how Tolkien thought about the scope and continuity of his world. He wasn't writing sequels, he was building a legendarium. Which brings us to a particularly lovely little quote from Letter 165, written to his American publishers at Houghton Mifflin in 1955. quote, "The book is not, of course, a trilogy. That and the titles of the volumes was a fudge thought necessary for publication, owing to length and cost. There is no real division into three, nor is any one part intelligible alone. The story was conceived and written as a whole, and the only natural divisions are the books 1 through 6, which originally had titles." And it's not hard to see why Tolkien would bristle at the word trilogy, because in his mind, a trilogy implies three interlinked but separate narratives, each with their own arc and resolution. Something like the Godfather films or Star Wars. The original trilogy, at least, let's not get into the prequels or the sequels, cans of worms. But The Lord of the Rings isn't that. It's one massive story, with a single climax and resolution, artificially chopped into three because there wasn't enough wartime paper, and post-war wallets weren't thick enough to handle it any other way. And yet, despite all the compromises, the paper shortages, the title debates, the three-volume split, the story survived. And more than that, it thrived. It didn't matter that it wasn't a trilogy. It didn't matter that it wasn't meant to be broken into three books, or that Tolkien had to grudgingly accept The Return of the King as a title, even though he thought it gave too much away. What mattered was the story. And it still resonates, because the shape and heart of it, that single narrative arc Tolkien fought so hard to preserve, was too powerful to be derailed by a bit of mid-century publishing pragmatism. And honestly, isn't that a little eucatastrophe of its own? So where does that leave us today? Well, technically, The Lord of the Rings is a single novel, divided into 6 internal books, published in 3 volumes, and commonly mislabeled a trilogy. And you know what? That's okay. Because part of the fun of fandom is discovering little bits of behind-the-scenes lore like this. Not so you can correct people at parties like some literary Ted Mosby, actually, but so you can quietly smile to yourself when someone calls it a trilogy. Knowing the winding, paper-shortage-riddled path that brought Frodo and the Ring to print. Even great world-shaking stories are shaped by mundane things like budgets, shipping costs, and deadlines. If The Lord of the Rings had to be a fudge to survive, well, it's the most delicious fudge fantasy literature's ever tasted. So next time someone mentions The Lord of the Rings trilogy, you don't have to correct them. Just give a knowing grin, maybe raise an eyebrow, and enjoy that little fudge that is The Lord of the Rings.
Thank you to this episode's executive producer, The Old One. If you would like to support the Lore of the Rings podcast, visit ringspodcast.com/member. If you found today's Wandering of Middle-earth to be inspiring, please share this episode with a friend. Lastly, if you would like to connect with me, I am most active on Threads. Find a link to my profile at ringspodcast.com and tap the at symbol near the top. And thank you for wandering Middle-earth with me today.